This week, I'm joined by Peter Bauman, founder of a think tank that focuses on the science of what makes us human, and he's also the convener of an upcoming conference in San Francisco, Being Human 2012. And two of the leading scientists who are going to be speaking there, Richard Davidson, author of The Emotional Life of Your Brain, and David Eagleman, author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. In 1989, I addressed the 20th reunion of my Harvard class. I'd graduated in 69, and we'd been the class that spearheaded student protests that took over the university administration hall and led to a month-long strike of the university. And our causes had included removing ROTC from campus, creation of an African-American studies program, and reforming Harvard's behavior as a local landlord. So now it's 20 years later in 89, and I encouraged my classmates to live up to our youthful ideals. I recall focusing on environmental challenges. This was the time when we'd had a very, very hot summer in 88, and there was the first evidence kind of was getting publicity of man-made contributions to climate change. But I remember in that address when I asked myself where we needed to focus our attention in order to turn things around, I pointed to the environment within our minds. I pointed to my head and said, that's the most crucial spot. Now, more than another 20 years later, as my conversations about politics and economics and education and technology and ecology and so on focus more and more on the need to tinker with the human software that drives or interprets everything we do, I find myself paying a lot of attention to the fields of behavioral economics, cognitive neuroscience, evolutionary psychology, social anthropology, fields that promise, according to a lot of thinkers, to overthrow long-held biases and stories about what it means to be human. And as we use the tools of science to explore the nature of humanity, we're learning more and more about how our brains function and what motivates our behavior, what our built-in biases are and our blind spots. First, I'm going to give you the bios of each of the guests today. Richard Davidson is a professor of psychology and psychiatry. He's the director of the Weissman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and the Laboratory for Effective Neuroscience and the founder and chair at the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. All of this is at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was the founding co-editor of the American Psychological Association journal Emotion and was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2006. He is author, with Sharon Begley, of The Emotional Life of Your Brain. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist and best-selling author who holds joint appointments in the departments of neuroscience and psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action, and he's founder and director of Baylor College of Medicine's Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law. His books include Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, his most recent. Also Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia, Live Wired, How the Brain Rewrites Its Own Circuitry, and an internationally acclaimed best-selling book of literary fiction, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. Peter Bauman recorded multiple gold records with the group Tangerine Dream, and then he founded a record label, Private Music, which he later sold to RCA. He's a fellow at the Mind and Life Institute and serves on the board of the California Institute for Integral Studies. Now, Peter Bauman founded the Bauman Foundation to explore the experience of being human in the context of cognitive science, evolutionary theory, and philosophy. And he's authored with Michael Taft of Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers and the Rise of an Enlightened Humanity. Okay, so that's Richard Davidson, David Eagleman, Peter Bauman. We're going to have three voices plus my own, so I'll do my best to keep saying their names. And guess when you chime in, if I haven't said your name, say your name at the start of what you're saying so that people can follow the conversation. So first, welcome Peter Bauman.
Hello, Terrence.
Very good. And David Eagleman, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Richard Davidson.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about every week here. So I'm going to ask each of you in turn to briefly talk about your own personal path to the work that you do. And in the course of that, feel free to cite mentors or turning points or moments of decision, that sort of thing. And we'll start with you, Peter.
Yeah, hi, this is Peter, and, you know, it's probably a whole slew of things that got me where I am today, and you can't isolate one single cause. But you could characterize me as a generalist rather than as a specialist. I like to look at the big picture. And at the big picture, human beings have been in conflict as long as we can look back. First in physical conflict, and today in conflict with words and belief systems. And my view of the situation, the human situation, is that we will come to a point where we recognize that conflict in itself is really a lot of energy zapping and is not really conducive to fundamental well-being. So I'm very interested in trying to understand human motivation, human decision-making, all underlined by human biology and what drives us fundamentally, so that we can not try to fight to resolve conflicts, but take a larger perspective and understand why we're in conflict to begin with.
Very good. So that was Peter Baumann. He's head of the Baumann Foundation and convener of the conference, Being Human 2012. By the way, let me say that that conference takes place in San Francisco, March 24th, and you can learn more about the conference at beinghuman2012.org. Okay, David Eagleman, your path.
My path is I started, I've always been interested in science, although as an undergraduate I majored in British and American literature. But what I found is I was always reading books about the brain because it fundamentally is one of the most interesting questions that we're faced with is who we are, and the brain seems like the most obvious gateway to getting us some way into that problem. So I got a PhD in neuroscience, and the things that attracted me the most were the issues that this is the most complex thing we'd ever found in the universe. And somehow this 3-pound organ is us. That seems to be clear enough, because if you damage the brain, you damage the person, their personality, their essence, and so on. And yet, when we look at the neurobiology, it's like an alien computational material. It's something that we don't even recognize. We don't know how to build anything like this. If we found this in an alien spaceship, we would imagine this is from a civilization billions of years ahead of us. It's this sort of soft pink, self-healing, miniaturized computational material that can contemplate the cosmos. So that's the mystery we're faced with, is somehow we are integrally tied to this 3 pounds of strange pink wet electrochemical tissue, and it is us. So that's what got me into neuroscience, and then that's where I remain.
Okay, and it turns out, as I mentioned in your brief bio, that perhaps that study of literature did help, because your literary book did very well as well.
That's right. I've always kept my dream of being a writer of both fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah. So for folks who are listening, it also means that his work on science is probably pretty readable. Let me finally turn to Richard Davidson. Your path.
Well, from very early on, I was struck by how people varied in their response to life's slings and arrows. Some people were very resilient, and other people were very vulnerable, and that led me to a path of trying to understand emotion, because the differences among people in how they responded to life's slings and arrows were fundamentally related to their emotional dispositions. And that's where my career began, and from very early on in my career, I had the opportunity to be around a number of people whose presence and demeanor was just very infectious. They were wonderful people, kind, compassionate, the kind of people that I wanted to spend more time around, and one of the things I learned is those people had a common interest and practice of meditation, and that led me to go to India after my second year of graduate school to get a taste of what this might be like myself. And I came back with a very fervent aspiration, and this was now many years ago, to do research in this area, but the times just weren't right for it. We didn't have the right methods, and science was really not at all receptive to this. And then if we fast forward to the mid-1990s, I had an opportunity to meet the Dalai Lama for the first time, and that meeting very significantly changed my life and my career. And the Dalai Lama challenged me, and he said, look, you're using the tools of modern neuroscience to study qualities like fear and anxiety and depression. Why can't you use those same tools to study kindness and compassion? And there really wasn't a good answer other than that it was hard, but it was hard when we began to first study fear and anxiety. But that meeting had a pivotal role in my career and in shifting my emphasis toward the neuroscientific study of positive qualities like compassion and kindness and well-being. And that has been an important part of my journey since that time.
Very good. What I thought I would do is start talking about the conference and sort of the strands you all share in common and the whole field that we're kind of dealing with. And then as time permits, once we finish that part, go more in specific with each of you. So the Bauman Foundation says that it explores the experience of being human in the context of cognitive science, evolutionary theory, and philosophy to foster greater clarity about the human condition. And in the announcement for the conference, you say the coming decades will bring a shift in our worldview as fundamental as any in the past 500 years. How do you, at the Bauman Foundation, I guess this is for Peter, but the others can chime in because I know you're in sync with this, but start with Peter. How do you explore the experience of being human in that manner, and what does that shift look like?
Well, how much time do you have? It is a very, very complex issue, and if you look at humanity from an expanded perspective, historically, the best explanation of who we are came from religion, and it was a very simplistic, or rather simplistic answer. But as we gain more and more capacity to reflect on who we are and get more insights from various lenses, scientific lenses, new philosophies, we understand that it's not a simplistic single entity, but that we are more or less processes, individual processes completely intertwined and interconnected in a larger process, and a cultural process, and the process of life. And we're just beginning to recognize that you have to look through many lenses to even get a glimpse of who we are and what might motivate us.
Okay.
So the conference is designed to start that process, not to come to conclusions, but to really invite many different lenses to start shining a light on this.
So some of the lenses, Peter?
Well, it's cognitive neurosciences, it's psychology, and that's developmental psychology, social psychology. Then we have philosophy involved, and, I mean, you name it, and we want to have it.
Okay. You also write, and this one I'm gonna turn over to Richard and David, that as we use the tools of science to explore the nature of humanity, we're learning more and more about how our brains function, what motivates our behavior, our built-in biases, and our blind spots. First, Richard, then David, what are some of the bigger, more surprising, or more helpful discoveries that we've made recently?
Well, I think that one of the great discoveries in modern neuroscience is the increased understanding of neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the idea that the brain changes in response to experience and in response to training. And this is a very important idea, and the nature of the change includes mechanisms that when we were students, we were taught that they just did not occur. For example, that the brain can actually grow new cells. When I was a student, I was taught that the brain is different from other organs in the body. When a cell dies, that's it. We now know that that is just fundamentally wrong. The brain generates new cells each day, and those cells are taken up in circuits that play an important role in our most important behavior. So the fact that the brain changes in response to experience and training means that our brains are constantly being shaped, wittingly or unwittingly. And this provides, I think, a very important insight, because we can all take more responsibility for our brains and shape our brains in ways that I think are healthier and more positive. And that insight is, I think, a key motivator.
Okay, and I really, I so agree. In other words, I grew up with that same sense that, you know, your brain is your brain, and you lose cells, but you never gain them, and all of that. And that seems to have changed. Let me, before I go over to David, let me ask you about one other thing, which is a similar notion. Isn't it that we used to think that our genetic makeup was sort of a blueprint that we were born with, and that it was kind of fixed? And we've learned about epigenetics, that actually, though the makeup doesn't change that much, the way genes turn on and off is much more flexible and pliable than we knew. Could you speak to that?
Absolutely. That's a complementary and critically important observation. And as you describe, epigenetics refers to the regulation of gene expression. And so we're all born with a fixed complement of base pairs that make up our DNA, but the extent to which genes are turned on and off, the extent to which they manufacture the proteins for which they're designed, is something that is under dynamic control and is influenced by our environments, is influenced by our behavior, and is likely influenced by training that we may undergo. And so both the structure and function of the brain, as well as the expression of our genes, is highly plastic.
Yeah, and one of the things that was key in what you were saying there, Richard, is that that plasticity, both of them respond to the environment, but our, quote, environment includes our emotions and our thoughts and our behaviors, right?
Absolutely.
So that's powerful stuff. That was the voice of Richard Davidson. Let me turn to David Eagleman. Your choice for a big or helpful discovery that we've made recently.
A discovery that has been creeping up on neuroscience for quite a long time is the enormous amount that is happening in your brain that's happening under the hood of conscious awareness. So it turns out that when we measure things like if you move your arm, that's underpinned by a lightning storm of electrical activity in the brain, and yet it feels totally invisible to you. If it weren't for neurobiology, you wouldn't even have reason to suspect the existence of the electrical signals and tendons and muscles, because it seems effortless for you to move your arm. But it turns out it's not just moving your arm, it's recognizing a friend's face, it's getting a joke, it's falling in love. All of these things have massive computations happening under the hood, and yet we're not aware of any of those. And so the end result is that your conscious mind, the part of you that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning, that is the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. And as Carl Jung said, in each of us there is another whom we do not know. It turns out that you know, most of what you do and what you believe and how you act, all of these are generated by parts of your brain that you have essentially no access to and very little acquaintance with. And to me, that seems like an amazing truth. And in my book Incognito, I compare it to the dethronement that took place when Galileo discovered, you know, he clinched the proof that the Earth was not at the center of all the orbits, but in fact we now know that it's going around a sun that's at the distant edge of our galaxy, and our galaxy is one of 100 billion others. We're sort of finding the same thing in the brain, that the conscious mind is not at the center of what's driving things, but instead it's sort of far out on a distant edge. But the good news about dethronements is that they open our eyes to something much more vast and subtle and wondrous. So our view of the cosmos now is so much richer than it was 400 years ago, and that's the same thing that's happening with our brain and our understanding of ourselves and what actually drives us, where our ideas come from, where our drives come from. And one of the things that I'm very interested in is what all this means for social policy and how we can use this kind of information to update and fix our legal system.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up with you on that, David. So I see where the Galileo dethronement opens up many possibilities. Let me ask how the realization that the conscious mind is a player, but perhaps even a minor player in our behaviors, our attitudes, our responses, and so on, if it's in fact subconscious, unconscious, all that kind of stuff, how is knowing that going to enable us to actually get better?
So let me give you an example. One of the things that's become clear is that the right way to think about the brain is it's not like a single process that's going on. Instead, each of us is made up of multiple selves. You have different decision-making circuits in your brain that care about different timescales, for example. So if I put some warm chocolate chip cookies in front of you, part of your brain wants to eat that because it wants the rich energy source, and part of your brain wants to muster the fortitude to forego that because it doesn't want to get fat and be unhealthy. And so you can argue with yourself and be conflicted with yourself. And that's something that computers don't do. We don't know how to build artificial intelligence machines that run on conflict. But humans have all these multiple parts. What that gives us is a much richer understanding of ourselves and of other people. We come to understand ourselves as a multiplicity, and our behaviors in the end just are based on which way the neural parliament tips. And one of the very useful things that comes out of this, as an example, is the ability to think about the kind of person that you would like to be and structure things in your life so that when there's a battle going on in your skull, you can make sure that it comes out the way you want it to. So this is something that we call a Ulysses contract. So when Ulysses wanted to hear the siren songs, he knew he would behave badly in the presence of those mellifluous voices, so he lashed himself to the mast. And people can do that in all sorts of ways by, you know, when they're in a moment of sober reflection, thinking about the kind of person they want to be, the sort of life they want to have, they can structure things around them so that they'll make the right kind of behavior. And this is just one example of how getting more insight helps you to steer your life in the right way.
So what you're saying is that although what we now know is there's more power in the unconscious, and so that would seem, well, that's mysterious, that's out of our control, what you're saying is that basically the more accurate a picture we have of the brain, of motivation, of emotion, of behavior, the more accurate our map is, the more, even if part of what we're saying is that's unconscious, the more accurate it is, the more capable we are of being in charge.
That's right.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with three people today. That was David Eagleman, author of Incognito, Secret Lives of the Brain. I also have with me Richard Davidson, author of The Emotional Life of the Brain, and Peter Bauman, who runs the Bauman Foundation, who's convening a conference in San Francisco March 24th, Being Human 2012. You can learn more about David's work at eagleman.com. More about Richard's work at richardjdavidson.com, and more about the conference at beinghuman2012.org. Let me stay with sort of this broad picture a little bit, and the field much of this ends up in is a new field of positive psychology, and there are related fields. We've talked about them in which you all toil. First, how is this whole arena perceived and held by other scientists, other authorities? Who wants to take that? Richard.
Well, I could start. The scientists that will participate in this meeting, I think it's fair to say, are all highly respected scientists at very prestigious institutions who all many of whom have garnered important awards and have received funding from the National Institutes of Health, which is an important and prestigious funding agency for biomedical research, and have authored scientific papers in the best journals in science. And so, I think that at the cutting edge, this work is being received, I think, quite enthusiastically, and it's certainly penetrating into the mainstream. Having said that, I also quickly add that aspects of it are pushing the envelope and are on the borders of the mainstream. But by and large, I think that this work really, in aggregate, is having considerable impact in the various sub areas of psychology, of neuroscience, of neurobiology, and related disciplines. So, I think that the research in meditation, for example, just to pick one area where there has been some controversy, I think. Over the last decade in particular has enjoyed more mainstream support because we are learning more about the brain mechanisms that are associated with it. We're using more rigorous methodology to explore it, and the work is being published in more prestigious scientific journals. So, I think that when you combine all of that, there really is impact, the likes of which just have not been seen before in research in that particular area.
Anybody want to chime in?
Yeah, this is David. I would just say that one of the things that attracts us all to a life in science is this understanding of the vastness of our ignorance. So, and the longer we spend in science, the more it becomes clear that what we know is outstripped so grandly by what we don't know. So, having conferences like this is extremely exciting, I think, not only for us, but even for our colleagues who might just be listening in. We're at a period in time when we realize how little we understand about fundamentally what it is to be a human, how other people affect us, how our emotions affect us, how our culture, the chemicals around us, all of this, how that makes us, gives us the thoughts that pop up into our conscious mind, make us behave the way we do. So I think that sort of excitement about the question is infectious because there's no scientist in the field who could possibly pretend as though we understand those answers.
Yeah. Is what we're learning in these fields being used yet to make the lives of the relatively wealthy better, or are they beginning to help raise the life experience of the billions currently still in poverty? I know that may sound like a big leap, but I think you get what I'm saying. When some people hear about positive psychology and what it entails and how, you know, we better ways to be happy and things like this, I think some people would consider that a luxury when, in fact, so many people are struggling for survival. Where does this field fit on that sort of continuum?
Well, Terrence, this is one of my favorite subjects. And
this is the voice of Peter Bauman.
This is Peter, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. There is no simplistic answer to this. It's very obvious that if you're hungry and you don't have any shelter, that these subjects are not very interesting to you. So, of course, there is a little bit of an elitist flavor to it, but I believe that we ought to look at humanity as a whole, and many things that have been discovered over the years benefited maybe in the beginning some individuals, but in the large picture, we are all sitting in the same boat. And we all have to try to understand how we affect each other and where fundamental being lies. So we have to make sure, and technology historically has been extremely beneficial in and starting to provide basic needs for everyone. And I believe the same now happens in science that we're addressing here, that once we understand the fundamentals, it will have bigger and bigger waves that impact every single one on this planet.
How are we beginning to yet, or how can we use some of this new knowledge to accelerate the process of improving lives on the bottom? Have any of you thought about that one?
This is David. Yep. One of the projects I'm working on in my lab has to do with breaking drug addiction, which is a problem that people of all socioeconomic classes suffer with. And we're doing what fundamentally is a very simple approach, which we expect to be very successful, and that's using real-time feedback with brain imaging. And it rests on this notion that I mentioned before, that what's happening inside of the brain is essentially a battle between different parts that want different things. So for somebody who's, let's say, addicted to cocaine and wants to quit but has been unsuccessful, we put them in the scanner, we show them pictures of cocaine to activate craving in their brain, and then we can measure the amount of craving in these specific networks in their brain. And we represent how active those networks are by a bar on the screen, and the person's job is to make that bar go down. So in other words, they surf through their mental space and they figure out what they need to do to control the craving in their brain. And what they're doing is strengthening the parts of their brain that are involved with impulse control instead of impulse gratification. And they practice this over and over. And the idea is this will give them the strength to tip the battle towards the long-term decision-making. Now, this is the type of approach. We've just begun this, so it's science fiction right now, but it won't be in 6 months. And if it works, it'll be a real game changer. But this is the type of approach that's only made possible by this framework of understanding what's actually happening under the hood.
Yeah, and it goes back to that thing that we were talking about in terms of plasticity. In other words, it sounds like what this is biofeedback, which has been around for a couple of decades at least, but if we actually are saying that you can that you can control and actually change your brain and the way it's responding, this seems like an exciting area. I interviewed Jane McGonigal recently, who works with games. People familiar? Are you all three familiar with her?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so in her work and in her popular TED Talk and in her book Reality is Broken, she points out that video and computer gaming is putting Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's theory of flow, which has been around again since the early 70s, but it's putting it into practice more extensively in the gaming industry than anywhere else. And I will just, for people, I will very briefly say what flow is. Csikszentmihalyi has done years and years of research in which he gets moment-by-moment feedback from people, and from that has come up with a theory that there is this state of flow, the state when you're engrossed in something and the activity is its own reward, and that it turns out that what promotes that feeling of flow is having clear goals, getting consistent feedback, and a certain amount of stretch between your ability and what you're attempting to do. Well, it turns out, of course, that a computer-run game has they have algorithms. That software can supply goals and feedback and that consistently accelerating stretch in a way that reality has a very tough time doing. Any thoughts from any of you about that? Because it seems to me this is related to everything we're talking about here.
This is Richard. I could chime in.
Yeah.
I missed a little bit of it because I got cut off.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. But the headline of what I said is that flow's been around for years. It seems like a wonderful set of insights. And then it turns out the first place that it's been able to be applied really with rigor and consistency is in the video and virtual gaming industries. And just any thoughts about A, that, and B, how that or other things can be moved more into the larger society?
Well, we just received a grant to actually develop games, online tools, either video games or computer games, and what they'll eventually be smartphone apps to for kids, for middle school kids, to teach them skills of mindfulness and kindness. And I think that we can begin to use this kind of technology to train specific kinds of skills and take advantage of the neuroplasticity that we were describing earlier in ways that make sense to kids of this age, and to take advantage of the kind of activity that Csikszentmihalyi has described in terms of flow that kids will enjoy doing. And so I think that this is indeed something tractable, and we need to do this in a way where we can rigorously evaluate the impact that these games may be having on the brain and behavior. But that is being done now, and I think that it is very likely, and in fact there's a little bit of research already published to show that certain kinds of games can actually strengthen circuits in the brain that are important for aspects of attention, and help children to better engage in focused attention. And so I think this is an area ripe for exploration.
Oh, I find that very exciting, Richard. And I would just mention to you that the Ashoka Institute, which you may know about, which focuses on social entrepreneurism, has a big initiative right now on empathy. And it sounds like there might be some sort of a connection there between what you're doing and what they're doing. I interviewed Rocco Bellick recently about his documentary Happy, in which both Richard and David appear as experts. And one of the key points that that film makes is that beyond a certain point, more money does not make us more happy. Would either of you like to speak to that one? David.
Yes. Well, this is a finding that comes out of positive psychology study, and I think this is well known by now, that over a certain level, let's say somewhere around the poverty line, having more money doesn't solve the problems of making somebody more happy, even though it's a widely held illusion that it will do so.
Okay. Here I'm asking you, Richard and David, to speak a little bit outside of your arena and represent the sort of the broader area that I know that the conference is going to speak to. I keep hearing that humans evolved for cooperation and social cohesion rather than for competition and greed. In other words, what allowed this weak, slow, fairly small creature to achieve as much power and success as it has was those key factors of cooperation and social cohesion. Now, let me start again. I'll start with you, David, and then go to you, Richard. And Peter, if you want to chime in, let us know. Can you speak a bit about that? And how do you explain the enormous greed that sparked the recent global financial crash, for instance, that has millions suffering? Does that mean that these people are outliers, that the people who are acting that way are outliers, or is there something else going on here?
Well, this is sort of a new branch of neuroscience called social neuroscience, and it comes about because brains were traditionally studied in isolation. You would look at a brain and say, this is the visual area, this is the area for hearing, and so on. But what's become clear is that brains are very social organs, and a lot of the circuitry of the brain has to do with interactions with other people. Now, I'm not sure that we could say that it's all about cooperation and altruism, because in fact there's plenty of greed still in there, and part of the social circuitry that people have is figuring out manipulations of social situations. And so when it comes to things like the financial crisis, it doesn't sort of come as a surprise to neuroscientists that there will be people who will exploit holes in the system to try to get personal gain. Nonetheless, what's becoming clear is that everything that people do, with the exception of people at the extremes who have social dysfunction, everything people do is tied into this very tight fabric of what other people think, how other people view them,
how they can move up through social ladders, and so on. And the issue of empathy that you touched on before is just one of many sub areas that people look at to understand, okay, how is it that I'm representing you in my head, and how is it that I come pre-equipped to represent you and lots of other people, the whole society, in everything that I do.
And David, let me go to you now, because it seems to me that this is one of those places, as Richard was laying that out, where that battle between the different me's or the different I's inside is going on.
That's certainly the case. When people are making decisions, some of them are about altruism and what will other people think of me, and other parts of the brain are doing this calculation about, can I get away with this without anybody catching me? And these issues are the roots of things like guilt and shame, which fundamentally are social emotions, because it's all about what will other people think of me when this happens. And so when you're deciding whether to make some act or not, you have to fight that out and decide the cost-benefit ratios.
Right. And now here's my question. Again, I will put this out to all three of you. If, in fact, like I said, I pointed out that one not because the greed hurt one person or two people, but that the cumulative effect of the greed hurt it, because we are global and so connected now. It isn't just that you hurt yourself or your family or even your tribe, but this kind of behavior writ large can affect millions. Democracy right now in America, as I look at it, seems to be, you know, being tied way, it's democracy by its very nature seems to be something which relies on cooperation and social cohesion, and yet being dominated now by rich, the very wealthy players and so on. Is anything that you folks are studying, that you folks are experimenting with, that we're learning, going to help us with those kinds of conflicts? Let me start with you,
Terrence?
Peter, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Terrence, again, this is I think, such an important subject. And there's one aspect that I feel needs to be highlighted here, and that is that we are a species that's still in a maturing process. And we are not optimal by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. And one thing that is missing at this point is really becoming aware how intertwined all of these aspects are. It's not simply to saying, oh, well, this is a greedy person and he should be out of here. Greed is a fundamental evolutionary adaptation for human beings. And it will wreak its havoc unless we become aware and put it into a healthy context. So what I'm emphasizing, and I know that Richie is working on this in his meditation studies, that building a greater capacity for awareness is really our ticket into the next phase of our evolution.
Okay. Richard, you want to pick up on that?
Sure. And this relates to several themes we've talked about, and that is the idea that in order to produce meaningful change, a key ingredient is likely to be awareness. And one of the sort of meta goals of the meeting as a whole is to bring increased awareness to the public of these different components of what it means to be human. Because as we become more aware of the constituents that that make us up, we have an increased ability to affect meaningful change. We don't know yet the extent to which we can become aware of processes, for example, some of which David has described, that are relatively non-conscious. But there's some work which indicates that with certain kinds of experiences and training, activities which we were previously unaware of can be brought to the forefront of awareness, and that can lead to increased capacity for change. So I think that this whole meeting is really about bringing more awareness to all of these different facets of what it means for us to be human.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Richard Davidson, author of The Emotional Life of the Brain. My other guests today are David Eagleman, author of Incognito, Secret Lives of the Brain, and Peter Bauman of the Bauman Foundation, convener of Being Human 2012 in San Francisco, March 24th. Their websites are richardjdavidson.com, eagleman.com, and beinghuman2012.org. Let me go, I'm going to go first to you, Richard, and then to you, David, with one more little juicy specific about your book. Richard, in your book, you talk, The Emotional Life of the Brain, you actually say that that our personality is composed of six basic emotional dimensions or styles, and that there's a particular brain chemistry underlying each. In about the next 2 or 3 minutes, can you tell people a bit about that and give them just another insight into what's in your book?
Sure. I talk about these styles that directly emerge from neuroscientific research, and I'll give an example of one or two styles to give the listener a feel for it. One is a style I call the resilience style, and it refers to how quickly or slowly you recover from adversity. Some people, when a stressful event occurs, are able to get over it very quickly and come right back to baseline. And other people, when the same kind of event occurs, they may be thrown off kilter for quite some time, and in the extreme, it could actually result in a more serious kind of disorder. And that style is traced to specific circuits in the brain that we've learned a lot about over the last decade in particular. And the idea is that each of us has all of these six styles, their dimensions, and we simply vary along each of these dimensions. Another style I refer to as the social intuition style. This is a style that has a lot to do with empathy, and it refers to the skill that a person has in decoding the social nonverbal cues of emotion. For example, facial expression, tone of voice, body posture. Some people are really good at picking up on those cues, and other people are not so good. And at the extreme, there are individuals with autism, for example, that have a really difficult time picking up on those kinds of cues. And again, that is tied to particular circuits in the brain. The last part of the book is all about plasticity and how we can actually affect change in these styles if a person finds that they wish to make a change, that where they fall is not helpful and is interfering with some aspect of their life.
Right. A quote that you have is that well-being can be thought of as a skill. You learn it better when you practice it over time. I think this is going to be new to a lot of people. And then, as you say, in this book, not only do you lay out what you've learned, but you give examples of exercises that can help us take advantage of that neuroplasticity to move ourselves in the directions that we realize that we want to move. You say that by delaying gratification, you can strengthen the connection between parts of your brain, which I think would blow people's mind.
Right, and delay of gratification is a particularly interesting one, since research indicates that a child's level of delay of gratification, how good or poor they are at delaying gratification, is actually a strong predictor of adult outcomes. And so kids who are better at delaying gratification end up doing a lot better later on in life. And if we can teach kids how to better strengthen those skills when they're young, we can set them off on a more positive trajectory.
Okay, let me turn to you, David Eagleman, just to go a little bit deeper into what your book, Incognito, says. How much of our lives are determined by choices and behaviors that are hardwired, unconscious, and beyond our control, and how much are in that area where we're the manager?
Well, the vast majority is happening incognito, so to speak, where you don't actually see the operations that are going on. That doesn't necessitate that it's hardwired. These things can be changed. I think a good analogy is that the conscious mind is something like the CEO of a company whose job it is to manage, let's say, 100,000 people, the CEO can't possibly keep track of all the details of the company, what software people are running on their desktop and where the roles are coming for the cafeteria and so on. Nor would the CEO want to do that job even if he could. So the CEO's job is really to think about the long-term management of the company. And in some sense, he or she only gets alerted when things aren't running correctly. When the company is running itself just fine, the CEO can kick the feet up on the desk. And that's a pretty good analogy for what's happening with the conscious mind. It's the most abstracted version of all the activity in the brain. It's the part that represents the you in its with all the details stripped away, just the summary of everything. And the CEO does feedback and give instructions to the rest of the company. I mean, if you decide that you want to become a good tennis player, you need to use your conscious awareness to practice and hold the racket just right and step into the ball just right. And what happens is by practicing this enough times, you essentially burn this task into the circuitry of the company below. And so that's essentially what's happening, is that most of the physical operations are happening out of sight, but the CEO can manage the long-term vision.
And then I would just want to give you again a chance to give people some sense of the book. It seems one of the great things about your book, David, is it answers a lot of those like questions that would be great at any cocktail party or any online chat and so on. Why does your foot jump halfway to the brake pedal before you even are aware there's a danger? Tell people just briefly two or three of the other kinds of things that you deal with, and then I want to go to kind of a sum up.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it turns out that there's so much happening under the hood that drives our behavior. I'll give one example. There was an experiment done some years ago where men were asked to rate the attractiveness of women's faces in a series of photographs.
Right.
And they rated from 1 to 10 how attractive they thought the women were. It turns out in half the photographs, the women's eyes had been dilated with eye drops. And the men uniformly found themselves more attracted to those women. But the thing is that none of the men were consciously aware that the women's eyes were dilated, and nor presumably were they aware that dilated eyes is a biological sign of sexual readiness. But their brains knew and picked up on that right away and drove them to find those women more attractive. And I think that's a good example of the kind of direction that we get all the time in our decision making that we're not aware of the influences on them.
Very good. That was the voice of David Eagleman. Peter, I will give you the last word. Success at your conference March 24th will be what?
Success will be that we start a conversation that takes into account not only our rational but also our emotional qualities as human beings, and that we start the ball rolling, that this is becoming a public conversation, and that we understand that we're extraordinarily complex human beings, and that we have to be aware of each other and raise each other. We can't do it on our own.
Very good. The conference is Being Human 2012, San Francisco, March 24th. Richard's book is The Emotional Life of the Brain. David's book is Incognito, Secret Lives of the Brain. The websites are richardjdavidson.com, Eagleman.com, and beinghuman2012.org. You can listen to this week's conversation anytime by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have that delivered to you either at iTunes or at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or it's also called AWorldThatJustMightWork.com, the same website. So at either one of those, you can find the podcast, you can sign up to have them delivered to weekly. At my site, you can also sign up to have a weekly announcement telling me who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about. And you can also do that by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, TEMCNALLY@mac.com. Finally, thank you to Peter Bauman, David Eagleman, and Richard Davidson. Keep up the good work.